welcome to this Thursday, very cold edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We are glad that you are spending time with us today. Coming up in just a bit, turn these cold and snow days into learning days with Winter Science at Home, as North Dakota Gateway to Science educator Annie Beck shows us how animal tracks and snowflakes can spark STEM curiosity. We'll also hear a powerful personal story from the courtroom in a segment from The Tell. We'll also have a Plainsfolk essay from Dr. Tom Easern. He'll trace the deep prairie roots of venison shezleek. I'm Craig Blumenschein from Prairie Public, and this is A Closer Look with the Monitor, our weekly conversation that goes beyond the headlines with reporters from the North Dakota Monitor, digging into the policy decisions and political dynamics shaping life across North Dakota. This week, we're focusing on the fragile state of rural health care. A critical access hospital in Elgin, North Dakota, is on the brink of closing, and lawmakers right now are considering emergency legislation during a special session that could determine whether it survives. Joining me from the state capitol is North Dakota Monitor reporter Jacob Orledge. He's been covering the financial crisis at Jacobson Memorial Hospital in Elgin and the bill that the legislators are looking to advance to try to keep its doors open. Jacob, welcome back to A Closer Look with the Monitor.
Thanks for having me back again, Craig.
You're sure welcome, Jacob. Describe for us, please, Jacobson Memorial Hospital.
So Jacobson Memorial Hospital is a critical access hospital in Elgin, in Grant County. That's in southwest North Dakota. The hospital has 30 beds, roughly the right size for a critical access hospital, an emergency room. It operates three healthcare clinics, one in Elgin, another in Richardton, and a third in Glen Ullin. And then there's also an associated ambulance service that works with the hospital. The hospital operates those ambulances and pays for the staffing. And then the hospital also has a number of swing beds included in that 30-bed total that are used for long-term care on a swing bed basis.
Now, Jacob, you describe Jacobson Memorial Hospital as being essentially, fiscally here, payroll to payroll. How close is this hospital to closure? And what tipped leaders into saying that, hey, action is needed now during this special session, not later?
Well, the phrase payroll to payroll was actually a quote given to me by the hospital's current administrator, Kristen Hyde. She is the chief operating officer of the hospital, and she's acting as the lead administrator because they do not currently have a chief executive officer, a CEO. According to Kristen Hyde, when I spoke to her last week, they're operating payroll to payroll, and they're just hoping enough revenue comes in every pay period to meet the next payroll and pay their staff. She said that two pay periods ago, they had to take out a line of credit with their local bank to meet payroll. Now, further statements today from Matt Hager, a member of the hospital's board, when he was testifying in front of lawmakers during the special session, he said that they were able to meet the last payroll comfortably, but they are still in relatively dire straits financially. If the hospital can't meet their payroll at any given point, there is a danger that it will have to close down. Today, Matt Hager, the board member, stated that the board has been considering all options in response to a question. He mentioned that they had considered declaring bankruptcy at one point. And he also added that even if they do not get this bridge loan from the state, the board will continue to pursue all avenues and attempt to stay open. That is the state of affairs as it stands right now.
Give us a sense, if you can, what the closure would actually mean for Elgin and surrounding communities, and not just for healthcare access, but for jobs, emergency services, daily life.
So it would have a very significant impact on local daily life. The hospital employs 130 people. Just for size comparison's sake, Elgin, the city the hospital is located in, has 543 residents as of the 2020 census. The county it is located in, Grant County, has 2,301 people, according to the 2020 census. So as Hager pointed out during today's hearing, those 130 jobs represent 5% of all jobs in that county. There's also the ambulance service that's closely tied to the hospital. There's those three clinics. There's the hospital itself. There's the swing beds for long-term care. All of that would potentially close if the hospital were forced to close its doors.
The special session that is now underway in Bismarck, of course, is focused on federal rural health transformation program money that likely will come to the state. In your discussions with legislative leaders, why was this crisis warranted inclusion in this overall discussion about the rural health transformation program now?
So the supporters of this bill see it as fulfilling essentially the same mission. This money is not coming from the federal funding, the rural healthcare transformation program funding. That was the cause of the special session and why it was called. But those dollars are intended to help transform rural health care in places like North Dakota, and specifically like Elgin, North Dakota. The supporters of the bill see this bill as helping to keep open one of those rural hospitals that the federal funding is also intended to help. So the supporters of the bill really see this as one and the same mission there.
Prior to the session, this bill advanced unanimously. What have you heard from lawmakers about their feeling of the urgency of the situation? Has it been certainly communicated well?
Yes, I think everybody is on the same page in that this is extremely urgent, and that's why it was allowed to be introduced into the special session. Just for a bit of background on that, there were five bills that were guaranteed to be introduced into the special session. Those five bills were associated with the rural health care dollars coming from the federal government. And then on Tuesday of this week, legislative management, a committee of legislative leaders, met Tuesday afternoon to consider proposals from lawmakers for other bills and to hear their pitch on why those bills were urgent and important enough to warrant inclusion in what the legislature hopes is only going to be a three-day special session. There were 19 bills that were proposed. The Legislative Management Committee accepted seven of them, and those seven were introduced today during special session. One of those seven was the Elgin Hospital Bill. And essentially the bar to clear that lawmakers were looking for is that this was very important and that it cannot wait for the regular session that's going to be beginning in 2027, approximately a year from now.
I want our listeners to know that Jacob and I are visiting on Wednesday evening. And when he speaks of today, he's talking about Wednesday, even though this will air on Thursday on Main Street. Let me ask you about the bill itself. I would like you to, I guess, to walk us through it. How would this emergency low interest program work, and what safeguards are built in?
Absolutely. I'd be happy to do that. Just a quick note before I do. I do want to note that, like you mentioned, I am speaking at approximately 7 o'clock Central Time on Wednesday evening. And as we speak right now, the Joint Appropriations Committee is still meeting tonight. And one of the bills that they have yet to discuss is this bill that we are talking about regarding emergency loans for hospitals in North Dakota. And so anything that I say now, this bill could potentially be amended tonight or tomorrow, Thursday, when it's on the floor. But to the bill itself, the bill would essentially add on to an existing loan program. There's a loan program called the Medical Facility Infrastructure Loan Program, and this bill would add on to it with a essentially a sub-program called the Emergency Operating Loan Program. These emergency loans would be available to nonprofit hospitals in cities under 2,500 population. The hospitals will have to assuming the bill passes, the hospitals will have to apply for the loans by March 31st. They'll have to submit financial information, an operating plan moving forward, cash flow projections, and any other associated documentation to prove that their business model is sustainable moving forward. These applications and all of these associated documents will be being submitted to the Bank of North Dakota, which will be administering the program. The Bank of North Dakota will then evaluate the application and make a determination as to whether they wish to grant the loan. The loan itself, $10 million in total, is proposed to be appropriated for this program. Any loan to an individual hospital will be capped at $5 million. The interest on that loan will be capped at 2%. The term of the loan cannot exceed 11 years, and the first year of the loan's payback can be interest only at the Bank of North Dakota's discretion. As far as safeguards, that will be up to the Bank of North Dakota. They will be handling that process. And the bill's sponsor, Senator Donald Shively of District 31, said that in his discussions with the Bank of North Dakota, he was told that the bank would likely hire outside consultants to do an evaluation of the hospital's business plan, because the Bank of North Dakota themselves are not healthcare experts, and they'd like to get that outside opinion on the hospital's business plan. Now, that is something that was told to Senator Shively, and Senator Shively then told to me and to other lawmakers.
Lawmakers have emphasized that this is not a gift, and I use that in quotes. First of all, is that correct? And then how significant is the requirement that hospitals demonstrate a viable business plan that you just talked about to regain solvency?
I will tackle the second half of that first, and that will be largely up to the Bank of North Dakota unless the bill is amended to require certain specifications between now and passage. As far as it not being a gift, quote-unquote gift, that is... When they say it's not a gift, they mean it is not a grant. If a hospital is awarded a $5 million loan through this program, as currently proposed, they will have to pay it back. It will not be forgivable or anything like that. The idea is to essentially restructure their debt at a lower interest rate. They will still have to pay it back. It will not be a grant, and therefore, as the supporters have said, it will not be a quote-unquote gift.
Jacob, is it your sense that this bill was designed solely with Elgin in mind, or are there thoughts or concerns that other hospitals soon could qualify?
I will say yes and no to that question. Yes, in the sense that this bill was prompted by the Jacobson Memorial Hospital situation in Elgin, and it was designed with their situation in mind. It was written with a deliberately narrow set of requirements, eligibility requirements, and a very narrow application window. To ensure this isn't a long-term program.
I'm Craig Blumenschein, and you're listening to A Closer Look with the Monitor. It's our weekly conversation that goes beyond the headlines, and it's with reporters from the North Dakota Monitor. This week, we're focusing on the fragile state of rural health care, and specifically a critical access hospital in Elgin, North Dakota, that's on the brink of closing. Jacob Orlich from the North Dakota Monitor, he's a reporter, and he's been covering the financial crisis at Jacobson Memorial Hospital. He is my guest. I want to talk about accountability and oversight. Jacob, you pointed out that financial audits have showed serious internal weaknesses at the hospital. How did those findings then influence lawmakers' thinking about whether to step in?
So I can't speak for lawmakers' thinking themselves, but they have not mentioned the audits until this afternoon. And the context of this afternoon was asking if there was a more recent audit than the 2023 audit that is available online, and there is not. The audit that I found from 2023 in the course of my reporting did note several concerns that the auditors had raised to the board primarily concerning internal controls on the flow of money due to limited staffing, which is not terribly unusual for a smaller facility in a rural area. But I do not believe, or at least I have not been told, that those audits played a role in this topic.
Do you have a sense of whether the hospital's board have already made some changes to address that 2023 audit?
I can't answer that question in relation to the 2023 audit. What I can tell you is that the board became aware of this current situation and the severity of this current situation last summer. Kristen Hyde, the hospital's administrator, told me the board began becoming aware of just how bad the financial situation was in August or September of last year, 2025. And almost immediately, they began getting more involved with the hospital's operations, and they began taking a larger role there. Fast forward to November of last year, and the hospital parted ways with their then chief executive officer. Kristen Hyde took over as the lead administrator for the hospital as the chief operating officer. And since then, the board has put together a strategic plan to essentially return the hospital to solvency. Think of this as a business plan moving forward. And they've begun implementing a lot of the associated measures, right-sizing staff without any layoffs, by adjusting titles and not filling vacant positions and things of that nature. They have stopped outsourcing billing operations, which was done under the previous administration with the hospital. And they've returned that in-house, and they believe that's going to make a significant difference. And then there were also other revenue operations that they've made tweaks to that they believe will maximize revenue moving forward through programs like the 340B program and others. So the hospital, according to Kristen Hyde, the administrator, and Matt Hager, the board member who spoke to lawmakers today, both said that the hospital has already begun making changes. There are more changes in the future, and they are very confident they will return to a positive cash flow by December 2026.
Jacob, you've noted that other hospitals, that are the rural hospitals in North Dakota, are struggling, but not to the same degree. Does the Elgin case reveal anything about the broader vulnerability of North Dakota's critical rural access hospitals?
I'm not sure I'm qualified to answer that question, Craig. What I can tell you is that I did speak to Tim Blossel with the North Dakota Hospital North Dakota Hospital Association, and he said that many critical access hospitals that are described as financially struggling are usually year to year, whether they show a profit or if they are in the red, and they usually find a way to make it work over the long term. That differs from the situation in Elgin, where the Jacobson Memorial Hospital is simply in financial trouble right now. It's not year to year. They need to take measures now. I would say, based on the interviews I've conducted, based on the comments from lawmakers during Tuesday's legislative management meeting and during today's hearings, I would say the main takeaway that nobody would disagree with is that the boards of nonprofit hospitals like this one need to stay involved and ensure that they are staying educated on the operations of their hospital and the healthcare industry as a whole, and just ensure that that oversight and that accountability is always present, so that if there is an issue, they can take action before it snowballs into the current situation.
Jacob, do you sense, of course, the special session will extend now through Friday. Do you have any sense of whether hurdles will stand between this bill and the actual money reaching the hospital in Elgin, Jacobson Memorial?
It's too soon to say. Like I mentioned a few moments ago, the Joint Appropriations Committee is meeting as we speak, so there could be amendments and material changes to the bill in its current form before we all leave the Capitol tonight. What I can tell you is that if the bill one way or the other will go to the floor and be considered by the full House and the full Senate over the course of the next 2 days, if that bill is approved and put into law in one form or another, the governor will have to sign it, and then the process will shift into the Bank of North Dakota's hands and the hands of any hospitals that wish to apply. They'll go through that application process, and the Bank of North Dakota will make those determinations, and how it shakes out is up to them.
Is there any sense of how quickly, going through that process you described, the hospital in Elgin could then realistically capture those funds to help it stay open?
Not as of this point. The only hard date that we have right now is that the application window will close on March 31st of this year. So that is the deadline for any hospitals to submit applications for the loans. Of course, they can submit applications sooner, and then the Bank of North Dakota can begin their evaluation process sooner.
That's Jacob Orledge. He's a reporter with the North Dakota Monitor. You can read his and all of his team's coverage of the special session, including the future of Jacobson Memorial Hospital in Elgin, at northdakotamonitor.com. All of the Monitor's reporting is available without paywalls or subscriptions, and you could subscribe to A Closer Look with the Monitor, our weekly podcast, wherever you get your favorites. This podcast will be posted weekly Friday mornings on the Monitor's website at northdakotamonitor.com and all major podcast platforms. It's also available on Main Street's broadcast and as a Prairie Public podcast. Jacob, thank you so much for helping us take a closer look.
Jake, thanks for having me on.
That's A Closer Look with the Monitor. I'm Craig Blumenschein. To come on this cold Thursday's Main Street, we'll check in with the North Dakota Gateway to Science. We'll talk about winter science at home. We'll hear a powerful The Tell story from the courtroom. And we'll also check in with Dr. Tom Easern in another of his great Plains Folk essays. That's all ahead. Stay with us. This is Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. And if you're looking for a hero, look no further than this story we're about to share from last month's The Tell, Fargo's live storytelling event. Here's Jean Hanning from The Tell stage.
Hi, this is my first time, so my story starts kind of in the 60s. I grew up in the 60s. Don't worry about my age. But, you know, in the 60s, the way women were treated is a little bit different than the way women are treated today. I remember sitting at a family meal, telling my uncle, the doctor, that maybe someday I could be a doctor, and he looked at me and he goes, "No, women make better nurses." When I graduated from college, I married a guy who lived in Moorhead, Minnesota. I grew up in Illinois, so I moved here. And there were no teaching jobs, so I took a job in a law firm as a receptionist. So this is the 70s, and in the law firm, the men were lawyers, and the secretaries and receptionist, me, we were girls. So when you watch these episodes of Mad Men, there is some truth in what you might see. So I was a receptionist, and then the law firm decided to hire a paralegal, and they wanted a college graduate, and that was me, so I said I could do that, and they weren't sure because I was one of the girls. But I did get trained for a paralegal, and I spent some years as a paralegal in that law firm in Moorhead. As a paralegal, I did get to know some of the different attorneys in town, and eventually a woman lawyer came to my firm, and I thought, ooh, that's another thing I could do, so I went to law school. Now, when I started law school in 1982, one-third of the class was women, and that was amazing for that time, because there just weren't many women going to law school in 1982. And so this kind of was good. During that time I was in law school, we got a woman to be a judge, and that was exciting. And so the opening up of possibilities in the law for women was really starting while I was in law school. After I got out of law school, I had to look for a job, of course. And I found a job in a law firm that was, men were lawyers and women were secretaries or girls. But I was the first female in the firm. And when you're the first female in a business that's dominated by men, you need to, you know, kind of adjust to the way that you might be treated, or the way that people might look at you, or the way that a person might walk into your office and say, oh, you're a woman lawyer. Yes, I am. But I did go to law school and I do know stuff, so it worked out. Well, when you're new in a community, and as I said, I had been a paralegal and had worked in a law firm and knew some of the attorneys. I also knew some of the reputations of some of the attorneys from those years, and there were attorneys that were considered to be, you know, kind of confident in themselves and their abilities. And some were most confident in themselves and their abilities. So I'll let you translate that in your own way. Well, I started to represent people and I had cases, and some of my early work was in family law. And so one day in family law cases, sometimes you're in the courtroom with clients and sometimes there's hearings where you might be in the courtroom without a client. If there's a special need for you to have a hearing before the judge, something in the case. So on this particular day, I was in Clay County Courthouse, and it was a hearing without clients. So it was just the other attorney, and I'll call him Mr. Smith, and me, and we were having our discussion before the judge, and then the judge had to take a recess, and so we had to wait. The judges do this all the time. You just wait till I get back. And of course, we did. And we were sitting there. And as we were sitting there, Mr. Smith wanted to get something from the clerk. And in those days in the courthouse, the judges were men and the clerks were women. And so Mr. Smith says to the clerk, "Honey, I need you to get something." Well, I have a long memory. I do. And I don't forget. It has to do with my Irish background. So I stood up, I turned around, and I said, "Mr. Smith, if this is your wife or your daughter, you can address her as honey. Otherwise, it is completely inappropriate for you to use that type of a language for a clerk." And then I just stood there like this. And Mr. Smith turned to me and he said, "Well, Ms. Hannig, thank you for pointing that out." And then he turned to the clerk and he said, "I apologize." And then I sat down shakily at that moment. But I will tell you that from then on, Mr. Smith actually treated me with respect. And I was the absolute hero of the courthouse. Every clerk was so excited to hear what I had done. Thank you.
That was Jean Hanning from January's The Tell, Fargo's monthly live storytelling event, which takes place at the 4 and 4 above Side Street Grill and Pub. The next show is Thursday, February 12th at 7 p.m., and you can find more information on The Tell's Facebook page and on Instagram. If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for The Middle Live. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and science doesn't stop when you leave a museum. In fact, winter offers some of the best opportunities to explore STEM right outside your door. Annie Beck, a STEM educator at the North Dakota Gateway to Science, shares simple, hands-on ways families can turn snow days into learning days. Annie, welcome back to Main Street.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's start with something many families see every day in winter, tracks in the snow. We've got them in our backyard. How can people use animal tracks as a learning opportunity?
Yeah, so winter is actually a wonderful time to look for animal tracks because we've got the blank canvas of snow that we can see them in. So it's a really fun way of getting outside and using the science skills of observation, curiosity, trying to figure out where the animal's going or how fast they are, what's going on, measuring. And so to start out, it helps to have an animal tracking guide. North Dakota Game and Fish has a great one that you can download on their website, or there are lots of other resources you can use too. Some things that I like to do if I am out looking at animal tracks in their fresh snow is looking at differences between similar tracks. For example, there are a lot of similarities between cat and dog tracks, but for cats, you won't see the claw imprints, but dogs you do, because cats have retractable claws. Or squirrels and rabbits, similar pattern, they both kind of leap, and their front feet are land actually behind their back feet. But rabbits, because their feet are much fluffier and furrier, have a more kind of less clear pattern. And their front feet land a little bit off of each other. And so it makes a Y shape with their back feet, whereas squirrels, their front feet land side by side. So it makes a U shape. So it's just kind of fun to practice those observation skills.
We have both of those in our backyard.
Yeah.
We get to see them every day. All right. You also encourage families, Annie, to try snow science at home. What's a simple way to measure snow and then understand how much water is in snow? Good little experiment.
Yeah, so it's fun to look at the different states of matter when it comes to water. So what is it like when it's liquid? What is it like when it's gas? What is it like when it's frozen? And so converting one from the other is always a really fun thing to do. So for measuring snow, you can go outside and measure a certain amount of snow. So take, 2 cups or a gallon or whatever it is, and then take it inside and see how much water that is when it melts. If it's really, thick, dense snow, the difference won't be, the difference will be different than if it's a light, fluffy snow that we might get. So experimenting with that. Also, if it is currently snowing, taking a black sheet of paper or any black fabric outside to look at the shapes of snowflakes is also really fun. Snowflakes are formed by water molecules adding one layer at a time. And when those molecules come together, they form a hexagonal pattern. So the two hydrogen atoms attach to one oxygen, which is the water. And then those oxygen atoms form hydrogen bonds with the water, with the neighboring water molecules. Now, basically, I know that's kind of getting into the science there, but that's what creates those beautiful six-sided snowflakes of various shapes and sizes that you will find. And it also shows, because of that structure, that also shows how when water freezes, it actually takes up more space than when it's liquid, which is different than some substances. So hence the exploding pop bottle problem that you might have had if you ever left a can or a bottle in your car overnight during the winter.
Unfortunately. And ice, of course, floats.
It does. It does indeed. Yeah. So you can see that too as you are bringing in your snow, you'll see like some of the frozen still on top of the water. Yep, experiment with that.
It's just so important. And you can elaborate on this for kids and adults too, to get outside and see something that they can observe and experiment with and not just hang out on the couch.
Absolutely. It's so much fun to learn about the world around you and to explore and to question. And especially when we have so much of our year in North Dakota during the winter, to take advantage of that season, not have it be a season where you don't feel like, oh, we can't do outside things, to get out and have some fun and learn about winter science as well.
From animal tracks to snowflakes, winter offers endless chances to explore science at home as we learn In our weekly discussion with North Dakota Gateway to Science, Annie Beck is a STEM educator there. She reminds us that curiosity doesn't need special equipment in winter, really none at all. Just a little attention and a willingness to look closer and get out and have a little fun. Thanks, Annie.
Thanks so much.
The Bismarck Mandan Symphony Orchestra presents On Broadway, featuring vocalist Emily Walters, performing unforgettable Broadway favorites from the big screen, including Phantom of the Opera, The Wizard of Oz, Wicked, and more. The concert premieres January 16th and 17th at the Belle Mayhus Auditorium in downtown Bismarck. Tickets are available through the Bismarck Event Center, at the door, or online at bismarckmandansymphony.org.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Across the country, Indigenous communities are facing increasing levels of food insecurity. In response, tribes are stepping up their food sovereignty efforts. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman takes us behind the scenes of Food Distribution Day on the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming.
It's a chilly Monday morning, and a handful of people are tossing packages of bison meat from the back of a pickup truck into a wheeled cart.
We're gonna start counting out 350.
That's Northern Arapaho tribal member Jackie White. The meat's wrapped in white butcher paper and got picked up even earlier this morning from the Wind River Tribal Buffalo Initiative.
80. We're getting closer.
White is the tribal relations specialist for the Food Bank of Wyoming. The group is dropping off the bison at the Eastern Shoshone Tribal Health Building in Fort Washakie, one of two spots for the food distributions today.
95, 100. Okay, somebody take that and put that in there.
As the sorting continues, a volunteer with the Wyoming Children's Trust Fund takes a cardboard box into the storage room.
This is the chokecherry jam and then the letters that the kids wrote.
The letters are from local schools, and the dark purple jam is made from chokecherries picked in Longmont, Colorado, the homelands of the Arapaho people.
Oh, they look beautiful. Wow.
Then the crew zooms over to the second distribution spot to drop off the other half of the goods. Next stop, the Arapaho school. A forklift grabs pallets stacked with cardboard boxes from a big truck in the parking lot. They're rolled into the gym and set up in long lines filled with staples like beans and rice. But now it's time for the fresh stuff. Enter more local volunteers and high school students. It's all hands on deck. One team sorts produce into bags.
Apples, potatoes.
And then others go down the line of boxes, putting in the produce and the bison meat.
Putting meat in the boxes one by one.
Amidst all the action, I even get interviewed by a couple curious high schoolers.
I'm going to ask you to state your name and occupation.
Okay, my name is Hannah Haberman, and I am a journalist with Wyoming Public Radio.
Awesome.
Little Raven Oldman works at the school and says the students know the drill.
They've been doing this quite a long time, and it's really awesome to see them like just jump right in and get the job done.
Originally, a different grade would help out each month. But now?
It's just a mixture of, I think they enjoy coming here to do this, so they're like, I'll go.
Kids can also grab boxes to take home to their family, and some do. Old man says the best part is watching the kids work together as a team.
I know we're all struggling, you know, in our own way, but this really helps out a lot because food brings people together, and that's what it's about, family and community.
After all the boxes are filled up, it's time to get them to the long line of cars wrapped around the school building.
Yeah, it says two on the blue truck.
I've got some of those carrots.
No.
You guys want to break boxes?
Just pairs.
We toss them, that'd be awesome. Thank you.
Nayeli Hernandez is outside helping load boxes into cars.
Especially during like the government shutdown, I was like, this is needed, especially in Wyoming and rural places.
She's getting her social work degree at the University of Wyoming.
Food security is a big like protective factor in like specifically child abuse, but honestly in like all issues, and just like general welfare for like the community is really important for social work.
Jackie White is catching her breath after making sure the bison meat and chokecherries got into the boxes. Some of the elder boxes will get hand delivered to those who can't drive or don't have a car. White says the chokecherry jam is a small gesture, but it can have a big impact.
We want them to know that we love them, we value them, and that our elders are significant to us because they're our knowledge keepers.
She says the high school students helping out today are her heroes.
That's the goal, to teach our kids about giving back into the community, but they're stepping up to be leaders, and I love that.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Haberman.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Dakota Geriatrics, presenting a virtual event on dementia care, Thursday, January 22nd, noon to 4 p.m., covering activity planning, physical activity, and emotional connection. More information is available at dakotageriatrics.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and on this week's Plains Folk, NDSU historian Dr. Tom Ezern takes us into the kitchen and deep into immigrant foodways with the story of shishlik. From venison on the prairie to lamb on a skewer, it's a dish that carries memory, migrations, and a taste of home.
It's the best week of the year for our two dogs when I'm breaking down quarters of venison in the kitchen. It's good for their keepers, too, for, as with many prairie households, venison becomes our primary protein in winter. We have a great variety of venison dishes, some of which are time-consuming. But when we want something quick and simple with ties to the traditional culinary culture of the region, there's an easy answer. Shishlik. I remember our first encounter with this savory dish some 30 years ago in Richardton, the last installment of a Hauk family tradition serving morsels of lamb to their neighbors. I loved those juicy bites then, as I do now. I still like to pull in at Meridian Corner, the junction of Highways 81 and 18, for a basket of skewered lamb. Freeman, South Dakota, declares itself the center of the shishlik circle, from which the popularity of the dish has emanated. But how did it get there in the first place? The tradition of shishlik, or shashlik, comes from the Turkish-speaking Tatars of the Caucasus region. Germans settling in the Black Sea colonies of the Russian Empire picked up the tradition and brought it to the Great Plains of North America in the 1870s. A focal point for such immigrant settlement was Freeman in Hutchinson County, Dakota Territory, but it remains a mystery why shashlik became a thing in this locality of the plains, whereas elsewhere, the tradition remained isolate or disappeared entirely. Local historians say the popularizer of shishlik in Freeman was a carpenter named Johann Hellworth, who had a shop on the main drag. I explain it more in terms of chaos theory. Sometimes an imported tradition roots and flourishes, sometimes not, for no concrete reason we can identify. Shishlik proliferated in the recent culinary culture of South Dakota in folk fashion, mainly as bar food. Sometimes it's lamb or mutton. More often, the farther you get from Freeman, it's beef. It's more commonly deep-fried than skewered. Seasoned hardly at all with just garlic salt or seasoned salt, the common practice is to serve it with saltines, a faint echo of the flatbreads of the Caucasus. In 2018, State Senator Stace Nelson, representing Hutchinson County, brought Senate Bill 96 to peer, proposing to designate shishlik the state nosh, snack or appetizer, of South Dakota. The impetus was not just cultural tradition, but also tourism, promoting a signature food for travelers. Governor Dennis Daugaard was skeptical. He called the bill a waste of time, but he signed it. Be it noted that Governor Daugaard is of Danish immigrant stock, not German-Russian. That same year, 2018, Freeman launched the first annual South Dakota Shishlik Festival, which was an immediate success. Well, sure, South Dakota has dibs on the popular tradition of shishlik, but its historical roots are more general. It belongs wherever the Black Sea Germans settled. Taverns in North Dakota, especially in German-Russian country, would do well to add it to their offerings. At our house, Shishlik works for any cut of deer meat. Just cube it. I marinate mine in a bag with Worcestershire, Tabasco, a black vinegar, a drizzle of molasses, a splash of sour mash, garlic, black pepper, salt. Grill the skewers hot and fast. We dispense with the saltines and serve it on couscous. Now be careful. This stuff is like popcorn. I can't stop eating it. But Dr. Kelly saves a morsel for each of our canine kids.
That's Plainsfolk with Dr. Tom Ezern from NDSU. Today's essay, Venison Shishlik, reminds us that the foods we keep close often tell the longest stories of chance, culture, and community on the Northern Plains.
This is Dakota Datebook for January 22nd. Today is the birthday of Harriet Lake, who was born in 1909 in Valley City. Her mother was an opera singer, and her father, a traveling thespian. When Harriet was six, her father deserted them, and her mother, Annette, moved the family to Minneapolis, then to Southern California, where she was hired as a diction coach during the early days of talking pictures. Annette also prepared her daughter Harriet for life in show business, training her as a lyric soprano and teaching her piano. In 1933, Harriet started her career with a brief movie role in which she and co-star Lucille Ball played bathing beauties. They hit it off and started experimenting with hair colors and makeup while slogging through a quagmire of bit parts and walk-ons. Film mogul Harry Cohn saw Harriet in a stage performance and decided to cast her in a picture. But there was a catch. Too many Lakes in show business. He promptly renamed her Ann Southern. Her performance got her noticed, and in 1939, she landed a sophisticated comedy, Trade Winds, which gained her rave reviews. MGM picked up her contract, and her popularity was cemented in Maisie, in which Southern played a flippant former burlesque dancer with a warm heart and a lot of man trouble. The film was a smash hit and led to 9 more Maisie films. Anne leveraged her success, insisting that the studio give her another strong movie role for each successive Maisie. And Lucy? I got all the parts Anne Southern turned down, she quipped. In the 1950s, Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz boldly launched The Lucy Show, and soon after, Anne Southern launched her own TV career with a sassy character in a very successful show, Private Secretary. The best comedienne in this business, bar none, is Anne Southern, Lucy said. And after Southern left Private Secretary, Lucy and Desi commissioned their writers to create The Anne Southern Show. Again, she was a hit, and the show ran for 3 years. In 1986, Anne Southern was nominated for an Oscar for Best Supporting Actress in The Wales of August, co-starring Lillian Gish, Betty Davis, and Vincent Price. Robert Osborne, host of Turner Classic Movies, said there was nothing she couldn't do. Light comedy was her forte, but she was also a good singer, and the camera loved her. Anne Southern, the gal from Valley City, died in 2001 at the age of 92. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Mary Helm. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Lucinda Williams once made an album called Sweet Old World. Now she's made an album called World's Gone Wrong.
I mean, I always wanted to be able to write great protest songs like Bob Dylan did.
What Lucinda Williams wants to protest on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that wraps up this Thursday's Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Remember, you can hear this and all past episodes of Main Street at our website. Or better yet, why don't you subscribe to Main Street as one of your favorite podcasts? Tomorrow at 3 p.m. Central, it's a replay of The Middle with host Jeremy Hobson. And at 7 p.m., it's Science Friday with Ira Flato. From all of us here at Prairie Public, we hope you have a great North Dakota weekend. And we look forward to seeing you again next week right here on Main Street.